Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Kathy Kitts, and you're listening to The Resilient Brain. We come to you every Saturday from noon until 1 and talk about mostly things about the brain, as you might expect. Today's weather, which I usually give to begin with, it is actually kind of a gray day. The light's starting to break through, but I think for the most part it's going to be humid and a high of almost 90, which doesn't sound very good, but it does cool down in the evenings, at least it has been so far, so that's a benefit. Anyway, I'm going to continue reading from one of my favorite books, which is Brain Matters. Last week, we kind of went through some of the anatomy and how parts of the brain work, and we kind of stopped at the cerebellum, which is that little part. It actually means little brain, but it's a little sort of almost ball-shaped area at the back of your skull that rests on top of your spinal cord and kind of is responsible for movement and for planning of movement. And some latest research has shown that there is also the cerebellum is involved in planning in general. So, you know, that's kind of interesting late news, hot off the press. Anyway, so again, the book is called Brain Matters. It's by Patricia Wolf. And I'm going to start with talking a little bit about the thalamus and the hypothalamus. Now, hypo means lower. So there are two different parts of the brain. The thalamus is actually the larger part of the brain, and it's kind of a substation for the brain. Like, all of the sensory information goes to the thalamus first, before the thalamus then determines, you know, how to send that out, where to send the information, and so forth. And that's true of all of four of your senses, but the fifth sense, which is the one that's not included, is the sense of smell. The sense of smell doesn't go through the thalamus. It just goes directly into the cerebral cortex. And scientists think that that's because of a survival mechanism. Like, if you are about to eat something that you thought was, you know, good, but it really smells horrible, then your nose is going to tell you, you know, stay away from that. Or, you know, the smell of smoke, something's on fire, you know, you better run. And I'm talking about, you know, back in the caveman days when we, you know, first put some of these parts of our brain to use. So, interestingly, that sense of smell, again, does not go through the thalamus. It goes directly into other parts of the cortex. And so the hypothalamus actually sits a little below, hypo meaning lower. Like if you're hyperactive, you're higher active than more highly active than normal. If you're hypoactive, you're lower. You are active in a less concerted way. So, and both of those, the thalamus and the hypothalamus, sit basically in the middle of the brain, but also very close to the top of the brainstem. The brainstem extends actually, you know, into the brain itself, and it kind of shares a couple of parts of the brain with, like, the limbic system, which is the parts that are mostly responsible for emotion. Okay, so here we go. Thalamus and hypothalamus. Deep within the core of the brain, just above the brainstem, are two walnut-sized structures that play a critical role in regulation, in regulating perception and the body's vital functions. The thalamus is a small plum-shaped structure located in the center of the brain. So a plum, in general, is quite a bit bigger than a walnut. So, you know, the walnut would be the hypothalamus, and the thalamus would be more of a plum shape. So a little bit bigger and located in the center of the brain. And you actually have two of them joined by a sort of bridge. But as with most duplicate structures in the brain, they are commonly referred to in the singular. So, you know, actually on the right side of the brain, you have a hypothalamus and a thalamus, and you also have an amygdala and a hippocampus, which are, you know, related to emotion regulation. And then on the left side, you have the same structures. So the thalamus, the hypothalamus, and then, you know, the limbic system, including the amygdala and the hippocampus. So generally speaking, and I know I mentioned this last week, but generally speaking, the left side of your brain operates the right side of your body, and then the, you know, vice versa, the right side of your brain operates the left side of your body. So that's generally how it works. There are sometimes exceptions, you know, especially if you have what's called a hemispherectomy, where you would have one whole hemisphere taken out of your brain, and that's usually done because you have severe epileptic seizures, and that's one way to calm the brain. You know, it's pretty significant operation that, you know, people have to think about quite a bit before they go through it. But they know that, you know, connections can grow from that remaining part of the brain. They can grow to replace most of the function of what was taken out. So in that case, you know, the right side, for example, if that's what's left, the right side will take care of the left side of the body, but it will also grow connections so that the right side of the body is workable too. So it's pretty amazing. But so the thalamus is playing a critical role in regulating perception and the body's vital functions. So it's this plum-shaped structure, and named for the Greek word for chamber or inner room. So thalamus must have some part of it that means chamber or inner room. This brain structure is in a strategic position to act as a relay station to direct the flow of information between the sense organs and the cortex. So in other words, if you see something, you know, that input goes in through your eyes, and then they turn into electrical signals. So the actual picture you see turns into electric data, electric information, and that goes to the back of the head and then through the thalamus, so that it can, that thalamus is in charge of sending it to the appropriate place. If, for example, you are painting a painting, you know, you're looking at the painting. Well, the other thing you're doing is you are actually moving, you know, your hand and holding a brush. So the thalamus would probably send signals to your hand, your arm, you know, so that you could connect and do the process of painting. So let's see. So it's directs the flow of information between the sense organs and the cortex, and it's been called the gateway to the cortex because nearly all input from the sensory organs travels first to nerve cell bodies in the thalamus, where the signals are sorted and sent to the receiving area on the cortex. The one exception is the olfactory system, which means smell, so which sends its stimuli directly to the cortex, as I had mentioned. So again, it's called the gateway to the cortex because nearly all of the information coming from the sense organs goes first to the thalamus, to the nerve cell bodies in the thalamus, and it's there that the signals are sorted out and sent to the appropriate place where they should go on the cortex. So I might have stated that a little backwards with the example of the eye. So you take the, you know, information coming from what you're seeing, and that's captured by your eye, and then that is, then that raw information, which is electric signals, goes first to the thalamus, and then the thalamus takes apart the entire message. So it might in the case that I was referring to with painting, it might send part of the message to your occipital lobes, which is what processes visual data, and then another part of that message might be sent, like I mentioned before, to the cerebellum to take care of the actual movement of your arm and your hand. So, you know, that's a very rudimentary way of saying all that. There are so many ways to break it down even further than that. I mean, there are certain colors you might be dealing with, and there might be a teacher in the background who's, you know, instructing you on what to do next. So you'd have, you know, auditory information. So it can get a lot more complex than just what I'm referring to. But anyway, below the thalamus, because it's hypothalamus, meaning below, is the thumbnail-sized hypothalamus. So again, we talked about the thalamus being sort of plum-shaped, and then here it says that the hypothalamus is thumbnail-shaped, which is interesting because they first started off saying it was kind of a walnut. So the term hypothalamus tells us this organ is below the thalamus. It is a critical part of the autonomic, and even though it's called the autonomic system, you should think of it as the automatic system, because that's it, really the body takes care of this system without our conscious knowledge. So the hypothalamus is a critical part of that autonomic system. And along with the pituitary gland, which is part of the hormonal system, it's like the master gland of hormones, it controls functions necessary for homeostasis. Homeostasis being, you know, that even equilibrium state, that even state. Here they say that it's maintaining the normal state of the body. So homeostasis, you know, meaning some definition of normal for your body. So, for example, when the body gets too hot, the hypothalamus increases the perspiration rate. When the body temperature falls below normal, the rate of heat loss is slowed by contraction of the capillaries, and shivering ensues. So that shivering, you know, kind of is small little movements of your whole body, actually raises the metabolism of your body and can help to warm you up a small amount. So shivering ensues, which produces a small amount of heat. The hypothalamus is the control center for the stimuli that underlie eating and drinking as well. So if you eat too much or you drink too much, part of that might be connected to your hypothalamus. And, it's controlling body temperature and things like blood pressure and, like it says, eating and drinking. So, for example, if you have too much salt in your blood, the hypothalamus signals you to drink water to dilute the concentration of salt. We all have heard that too high a concentration of salt is, you know, not good at all for you. I mean, you can actually have some severe effects if you have way too much salt. If there is too much sugar in your blood, then it suppresses your appetite. So it's basically telling your body you have enough sugar already in your body, you don't need to eat right now. The hypothalamus also plays a role in regulating sex drive, sleep, aggressive behavior, and pleasure. So there are a lot of things that, you know, we're talking about that you don't necessarily, you know, think that you are regulating it yourself. If you've ever seen somebody with aggressive behavior, I mean, it tends to just come on all of a sudden, and it's not necessarily consciously regulated, except maybe afterwards. So, and then as far as sleep is concerned, that's a sticky wicket too. Sometimes people sleep way too much. Sometimes people get away with sleeping a very small amount. But there's actually supposed to be a normal amount for your own body regulated by the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus plays an additional role, one that is essential for survival. If you've ever been frightened by a snake or a spider or anything else for that matter, and found your normal body state changing rapidly, heartbeat increasing, palms getting sweaty, and respiration increasing, your hypothalamus is at work. It is this organ that controls the body's fight or flight response. And we'll look more at this response and how it affects learning in Chapter 5 of this book. And I have a real short story about that. It's true. If you think of anything, if you see out of the corner of your eye something that even resembles a snake, your body will automatically either make you jump or sidestep or, you know, even maybe start running. It's just one of those primordial instincts. But, you know, I grew up around snakes. One of my brothers, you know, loves reptiles, and he would bring snakes home. And in the Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, we only have two venomous snakes. One is the copperhead, and then the other one is the cottonmouth. If you get into western Maryland, you can run into rattlesnakes as well, but they're not really around this part as much, you know, near the D.C. area. So most snakes that you see, a cottonmouth is going to be in the water anyway. So if it's on level ground, it's not a cottonmouth. And a copperhead kind of looks coppery, although it could look kind of pinkish. So anyway, most snakes are not out there to harm you. You know, if anything, they just want to go about their business. They want to eat. They want to sleep. You know, they want to find a mate. Just like everybody, you know, every other animal in the kingdom, they have their needs, you know, that they have to get done. So the other day, unfortunately, a couple neighbors of mine saw a big, long, black snake. And, you know, they were so upset about it, and they went and ran after it. And one guy had a shovel, and the other guy had a rake. And, you know, they were trying to take the snake away from the area. And, I probably shouldn't have said anything, but, it's one of those things that I just feel strongly about. You don't have to mess with the snake. You don't have to kill the snake. You know, they actually are very good because they get rid of rats and mice and all kinds of things that you wouldn't want crawling into your, you know, house or under your house or into your apartment. So they're actually much better for you than, you know, some of the mammals that live around here. But anyway, they were trying to move the snake, and it was to the point where they were almost, I felt like they were almost going to decapitate the snake because they were holding this, you know, sort of shovel on top of the poor snake's head. And then one guy took the end of the snake and, you know, he's trying to just pull it along a little bit to get it out of the area. But then, you know, the snake is doing what he is doing to protect himself. He thinks he's going to be killed. So, you know, his head starts going towards his tail, which is being held. And so the guy freaked out, and he just throws the snake up in the air about 8 feet, and it lands, you know, on the blacktop of the, you know, the driveway of the parking area. And, you know, I think it was Stunned. It was either Playing Dead or it was Stunned. But in any case, I think when they tried to sort of shove it aside, it did start to move and move away from, you know, the area. But, you know, one person said that, you know, his wife was afraid because of her baby. Well, the snake's not going to eat the baby, you know. And it might cause a little bit of a fright, but if you think about it, it's not born into life to bother you. You know, it's trying to get away and mind its own business. So if they had just left it alone, it would have been, you know, fine. I mean, I have no idea if it ended up dying or, you know, if it survived. But I just wanted to say, you know, that's like when the brain goes on automatic overdrive. And yes, back in the day when we were living in caves and we didn't know the different types of snakes and things, I would say, yeah, probably you would have killed it out of fear and just make sure that it isn't a venomous snake. But, you know, you have to take into account where you live and what's around you. You know, some areas do have very dangerous snakes, and, you know, you'll learn about it if you ever travel there. Or, I mean, there are parts of Africa that have very venomous snakes and parts of Costa Rica that have very venomous snakes that I've, you know, seen and heard of. Not seen in the wild, but seen pictures of. But a lot of those snakes, too, are more nocturnal. They don't necessarily come across your path and try to, you know, get in your way, because they're really more afraid of you than we are of them. So in any case, I guess, you know, it relates to the brain, because sometimes the brain can go on these basic survival, you know, knee-jerk reactions because of back in the day when early man used to have to be more careful about things like this. So now that we live in the year 2015, you don't always have to, you know, strike out or run after a snake. If you were living in Arizona, you know, sure, it might be a rattlesnake. And if it lives near you, I would say you probably would, you know, want to relocate it or have a professional relocate it to an area, you know, 15 miles away. You don't want it living near you, because then the chances increase it, you know, that you might step near it and it might think it's you're trying to kill it, and so it'll strike out. So, but, you know, just in general, be nice to the snakes, because they take care of a lot of the vermin in the area, no matter where you live. So, okay, so where was I? I was talking about the signals being sorted and retrieved in the cortex, you know. So that hypothalamus, again, takes all the signals and they sort them out. Or no, that's the thalamus. And then the hypothalamus is more in charge of some of the autonomic type of behaviors that we take care of. So your blood pressure, your heartbeat, your ability or need for water or food, your sex drive, your sleep patterns, aggressive behavior, and pleasure. So that's when it talked about there's an additional role, and it's mostly for survival. And that's when it's talking about if you've ever been frightened by a snake or a spider or anything else for that matter, it's because your body has very, very quickly, I think it's like in one third of a second, if not sooner, your body puts it all together and says, you know, danger. And so, you know, the following things happen. You know, your rate of breathing increases, your palms get sweaty, your heart rate increases, things like that. And also you have adrenaline that is released, so that if you do have to run, you know, you're more in your top form to run. And it's interesting, okay, because I was going to say, they say that the hypothalamus is also the organ that controls the body's fight or flight response. You know, and I actually have learned since this book was published that we now refer to it as fight, flight, or or freeze. Because, you know, one thing, if you're going to fight, some people can't run away. They just freeze. So not only in a physical situation, being on a path walking, but also, you know, if you're like trying to do some schoolwork and you just don't get it and it's really bothering you and you get so bothered by it all that you don't, you know, you're just frozen. You don't know where to start, where to begin. It's just so overwhelming that you just freeze and do nothing. So it's fight, flight, or freeze response. And when it said that the hypothalamus is in charge of this, I was thinking, I always thought that the amygdala was in charge of, you know, fight or flight. So here we go with that answer. For those of you who don't know about the amygdala, it actually means almond. Amygdala means almond because it's almond-shaped. And it's another structure that's in the emotional center, the limbic system, which is very near the brain stem in the center of your brain. And you have one on the right and one on the left. So this says that another brain structure highly involved in the fight or flight response and located near the thalamus and hypothalamus is the amygdala. So they're saying that it's both the hypothalamus and the amygdala, whereas depending on what you read, a lot of times they'll just attribute fight or flight to the amygdala. So it's interesting to know it's partly the work of the hypothalamus. So if the brain could be said to have an alarm system, it would be these two almond-shaped structures deep in the center of the brain. It is also known as the amygdaloid complex because it is composed of three subdivisions, each connected to different brain structures or pathways. Well, I don't think I knew that before because, it depends on what you read and where it's from, but they're saying there's an amygdaloid complex and that there are three subdivisions. Well, so I hope that they give us the three subdivisions. the amygdala could be called the psychological sentinel of the brain. Okay, the psychological sentinel, and because it plays a major role in the control of emotion. Okay, so if you're quick to get angry or you're quick to cry or you're quick to yell at somebody or maybe you just freeze up when there's too much going on that you can't handle, these are all things that are controlled by the amygdala. Various groups of cells in the amygdala are designed for different roles. Okay, here you go. One group links to the olfactory bulb, so that's your sense of smell, and another to the cortex, which is that outer part of your brain, especially the sensory association areas. So meaning, you know, the ones that are connected to your seeing, your hearing, your sense of touch, your smell, and your taste. Still another group links the amygdala to the brainstem and the hypothalamus. So there you go. There's a direct connection between the brainstem, the amygdala and the hypothalamus. And another link between the amygdala and the brainstem itself. All incoming sensory data, except smell, travel first to the thalamus, which relays the information to the appropriate sensory processing area of the cortex. Okay, so things having to do with sense of touch go to that area that deals with sense of touch. Those, you know, for sight go to the occipital lobes. Those that have to do with taste would go probably to the mouth area, the tongue area, those things first. And then at the same time that the thalamus is sending information to the cortex, it sends the same information to the amygdala for evaluation. Okay, so the amygdala is connected to the thalamus and connected to the hypothalamus. So again, it's getting a little more complicated, but just think for sight, for example, you see something, that information goes into your thalamus first, and then it goes to the amygdala for evaluation. And it sends the same information. Okay, so the thalamus sends the same information to the cortex and to the amygdala. So it's able to think about what you sent, what was sent, and it's able to evaluate for emotional content. If the amygdala determines that the stimuli are potentially harmful, it triggers the hypothalamus, which in turn sends hormonal messages to the body, thus creating the physical changes that ready the body for action. So heightened blood pressure, increased heart rate, and muscle contractions, and by the way, adrenaline. How does the amygdala know that a particular stimulus signals danger? There seems to be two sources of this, quote, knowledge, unquote. One way the amygdala assesses the emotional relevance of a stimulus is by checking with the hippocampus, okay? The hippocampus is responsible for a lot of the short-term memory situations, and at night, those short-term memory stimuli, what's been held in the hippocampus, they get converted to long-term memory if you get proper sleep and if these are things that have been repeated a few times to yourself. So the amygdala, you know, checks, it sends the stimulus to the hippocampus for checking. And then the hippocampus, which is the structure that allows one to store conscious memories, okay, conscious memories, things that you consciously remember, you know, like I went to school today, I drove to the gas station, I picked up my son, I went to the grocery store to shop for dinner. Those are all conscious memories. If, for example, the particular stimulus is a curved shape, the amygdala, in checking with the hippocampus, may receive a message back that the curved shape looks like a snake and that snakes are potentially dangerous. This lets the amygdala know that it had better trigger the physiological processes necessary to keep you from being bitten. However, the hippocampus does not seem to be responsible for all memory acquisition. Research on conditioned fear in animals has led to the broader hypothesis that the amygdala lays down unconscious memories in much the same way that the hippocampus lays down conscious ones. This suggests that the amygdala forms emotional memories that can trigger responses without the corresponding conscious recollection that tie the responses to a particular event. So, in other words, if you suffer from panic attacks or you have phobias for no known reason, these might have been somehow you might have had a feeling of fear, and it could be nonspecific. Maybe it wasn't a particular thing that happened, but the amygdala can form that emotional memory without knowing what triggered it. So that's kind of interesting. This may be the source of panic attacks and seemingly unreasonable phobias. So now we're going into the hippocampus. I mean, that was just a really short overview of the amygdala. There's, you know, a lot more that could be said. But I encourage you to, you know, just Google amygdala on the computer, and even videos about the amygdala. There are such interesting talks and slideshows and actual videos that, you know, show in much greater detail what parts of the brain are responsible for what. So under hippocampus, although its name is derived from the Latin word for seahorse, because hippo actually means horse, and I think campus must have something, or maybe that's the other way around. I always thought hippo was related to horse, but call me if you think differently. And anyway, that name, hippocampus, means seahorse in Latin, and it looks like two paws curving toward each other. So it doesn't even actually look so much like a seahorse. It looks more like two paws curving toward each other. Without it, you would not be able to remember where you parked your car or anything else in your immediate past as soon as you stopped giving it your attention. The hippocampus not only holds memory of your immediate past, but also is the organ that eventually dispatches the memory to the cortex. So it's actually what transfers those short-term memories to the cortex of the brain. And that's where it's stored when it's called long-term memory. It's stored in your cortex. Long-term memory is more stable than short-term memory. According to Joseph Ledoux, professor at New York University and author of The Emotional Brain, the hippocampus appears to be crucial for you to be able to remember events in your immediate past, maybe even for a few years. Gradually, over years, the hippocampus relinquishes its control over the memory to the cortex, where the memory appears to remain, perhaps for a lifetime, in long-term memory. Well, I didn't know that it stayed in short-term memory for as much as a couple of years. I thought short-term memory meant just that, really short. And I thought it was more like a nightly thing that happens, that the short-term memory during your sleep turns into long-term memory. Well, it's quite possible that that is true, but that maybe some of the memories are held back in the hippocampus. And so when the hippocampus relinquishes control of the memory to the cortex, that's when it's called long-term memory, and it might stay there for a lifetime. So, in other words, once an episode is fully encoded in long-term memory, the hippocampus apparently is no longer needed for it to be retrieved. So you can take the hippocampus out of the equation. You don't use that when you're trying to retrieve your long-term memory. So if you have, you know, vivid memories from the past, those are all long-term memories. People who have suffered serious damage to the hippocampus cannot recall anything in their immediate past. Neither can they encode any new memories. An example of this deficit is vividly described in a famous case study of a man known as H.M. Oh, this poor man. In 1953, when H.M. was 27 years old, doctors performed radical surgery on his brain in an attempt to end the convulsive epileptic attacks he had been having since he was 16. The physicians removed large regions of the temporal lobes, brain tissue containing the major sites of this disease. Medically, the surgery was successful. HM's seizures could now be controlled with medication. Because the hippocampus was included in the tissue that was removed, however, HM essentially lost his ability to form conscious, long-term memories of episodes or factual information. These types of memory are called episodic memory and declarative memory. So I guess things that are associated with episodes of action are episodic, whereas factual information is something you can declare. So that's declarative memory. And they stand in contrast to procedural memory, which is like, how do you do something? You know, how do you screw in a light bulb? How do you light the pilot light on your stove? Things like that. Those are called procedural memory. They stand in contrast to procedural memory, which does not require conscious recall. We'll look more closely at the various forms of memory in a later chapter. So HM is an old man today, and he still lives to a degree in 1953, the year of his surgery. He can remember events that occurred up to about 2 years before his surgery, but has no memory of the events of the past 45 years. Wow. Brenda Milner at the Montreal Neurological Institute has worked with HM extensively during this period, yet he has little idea of who she is. Interestingly, HM is able to learn new motor-driven skills, such as mirror writing or puzzle solving, but he does not remember learning them. These are examples of procedural memory, which does not require processing in the hippocampus. Interesting. And can you imagine working with somebody for almost 45 years, and every day they come to see you and they say, hi, what's your name? And, you know, you explain to them that you've been working with them. Your name is Brenda. And then the very next day, you know, he comes and he says, hi, what's your name? As if he'd never met you before. So, you know, that's what not having a short-term memory looks like. So I guess, you know, he doesn't know the difference because he doesn't have short-term memory. But I just think it's kind of a sad situation. The next thing that this book goes into is just synapse strengtheners. So these are just ideas of some things you can think about or do. Number one, select one of the major structures of the brain, such as the hippocampus, and without looking back at the material, write a brief summary of where it is in the brain and what it does. Well, for those of you who are listening to this broadcast, you can simply replay the broadcast for yourself. You can replay it as many times as you want, and that, you know, that will give you the repetition that you need to have it become long-term memory, because you'll learn it. But you can go through this exercise to see what it is, you know, you don't remember. And then go back and reread the information and see how well you recalled it. Number two, suppose after reading this chapter you are talking to a fellow educator who wants to know why one should know the names of the structures in the brain and what they do. What would you say to that person? So you can think about the answer to that one. Number three, if you are reading this book as part of a study group, ask each member to select one or two major structures in the brain and prepare a presentation for the rest of the group on the location and function of these structures. Well, you could certainly take this to your family if you are not in a study group, or, you know, one or two friends if they happen to be interested in the brain, or their fellow teachers, and follow this suggestion of preparing a presentation. That's always a great way to learn yourself, is to repeat over and over again a presentation that you're about to make, because that will commit it to long-term memory. And number four, plan one or more lessons to teach your students the parts of their brains. Or it could be to your business leads, you know, exchange, or any ability to stand up and talk for 5 or 10 minutes, you could, you know, teach them something about the brain and why it's, you know, they should be paying attention to it. So the next part is actually going a little deeper into the cortex. So let's just see. Thus, brain anatomy, a short course, the cortex. Thus far, all the structures we've been discussing operate at an unconscious level. Michael Gazzaniga, director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Dartmouth emphasizes that most mental processes controlling and contributing to our conscious experience occur outside our conscious awareness. We are consciously aware of only a small part of what is going on inside our brain. Such structures as the brainstem, cerebellum, amygdala, hippocampus play critical roles in our ability to process information and form memories, and eventually to become aware of them, but we are not consciously aware of the activities of these structures. We now turn our attention to the part of the brain that allows us to be aware, to recognize and to talk about how we're feeling and what we're thinking, the structures that operate at the conscious level. So the cerebral cortex covers the cerebrum. The cerebrum is the Latin word for brain. And cortex, or they're going to tell you this in a minute, but cortex is actually a Latin word for bark. So you think about bark being the outer layer of a tree, so the cortex is the outer layer of our brain. And it's a thin layer known as the cerebral cortex or neocortex, so new cortex. The cortex, to a degree, even resembles the bark of a tree. It is wrinkled. It's about 1/32nd to 1/4 inch thick and is the so-called gray matter of the brain. The cerebral cortex is made up of 6 layers of cells. There are dendrites and some axons. If the cerebral cortex were taken off the brain and stretched flat, it would be about the size of a pillowcase or the page of a newspaper. Studies of human brains by neurosurgeons, neurologists, and neuroscientists have shown that different areas or lobes of the cerebral cortex have separate functions. Let's look at the 4 main lobes, which take their name from the skull bones they underlie and at their major role in processing information. So the occipital lobes, located at the lower central back of the brain. So just, you know, if you're sitting or standing, just touch the back of your brain, sort of the lower back of your brain, and those are the occipital lobes, the primary brain centers for processing visual stimuli. Covered by cortical tissue, this area of the brain is also called the visual cortex. It is split into many subdivisions, each playing a role in processing visual data coming into the brain from the outside world. Recall that visual stimuli are first relayed through the thalamus. So when stimuli reach the visual cortex from the thalamus, they are first processed in the primary visual perception area, where millions of neurons are further organized into areas designed to process different aspects of vision. Through intensive work in mapping the visual cortex, scientists have discovered motion-sensitive cells, color-sensitive cells, and straight-line cells. There are also areas for general scanning, stereo vision, depth, distance, and object detection. There's so many little subdivisions or parts of that, area of the brain. So Michael Gavaniga, in the book Cognitive Neuroscience, reports that between 30 and 35 of these visual areas have been identified in the occipital lobes of monkeys. So they have, you know, done a lot of work with monkeys, and they know a lot about the brain because of their work with monkeys and also with, diseased brains and people who have passed that have donated their brains to science. They sometimes can learn quite a bit from those. Once the incoming information has been assembled in these areas or it has been perceived, it then travels to the secondary or visual association area, which compares the information with what you've seen before and lets you know whether you are seeing an orange or a tree, for example. Note that 2 people can look at the same thing and focus on something different or see different things. What you attend to visually is the coordinated functioning of several brain systems. First, the visual perception area allows perception of the actual object. Your visual cortex then communicates with other brain systems to determine what visual information you have stored previously. Visual stimuli do not become meaningful until the sensory perceptions are matched with previously stored cognitive associations. In addition, we often prime our brains to pay attention to certain stimuli over others, such as looking for a friend in a crowd of people, or when directed by the teacher to see a shape of a certain color among a large number of different colored shapes. This is why telling students the objective of an activity is usually desirable. It allows the brain to anticipate the critical features or ideas and increase the likelihood that the brain will focus on the essential information. Now we move to the temporal lobes. And temporal, you know, has a lot to do with time. And we'll see how that affects what's learned in this section. On either side of your brain, just above the ears, are two lobes. So everybody touch right above your ears, like standing your hand up, you know, right above your ears. That is the temporal lobe. And so just above the ears are two lobes that curve forward from the occipital lobe. So now try to put your hand on its side and stretch all the way to the beginning of the or end of the occipital lobes, and that's what you will. That's the length of it. So, these are the temporal lobes whose main function is to process auditory stimuli, things that you hear. So the temporal lobes are composed of several subdivisions that cope with hearing, language, and some aspects of memory, especially auditory memory. Hearing is often considered the most important sense for humans. It allows us to communicate with each other and gives us information vital for our survival. The sound of an oncoming train tells us to move away from the track, or the sound of steps behind us tells us to check and see if we know who or what is making the sound. Deafness can be more debilitating than blindness, even though humans are highly visual creatures. Like the occipital lobes, the temporal lobes have many subdivisions. When the primary auditory region of the temporal lobes is stimulated, sensations of sound are produced. In addition, an auditory association area has links to the primary region and other parts of the brain and aids in the perception of auditory inputs, allowing us to recognize what we are hearing. So it seems to me that there are connections to many other parts of the brain, especially to recognize what you are hearing, you have to connect to some of the memory sites of, you know, previous examples where you heard something. Within these two major regions, groups of neurons have specific jobs, such as registering a sound's loudness, pitch, or timbre. At the conjunction of the left occipital, parietal, and temporal lobes, but lying mostly in the temporal lobe. Okay, so let's see. At the conjunction of the left, let's go on your left side, touch the left side of your head, and where it intersects the occipital and the temporal lobe, and then right above there is also the parietal lobe, okay? So you're touching probably a little bit behind your ear and just above. And that is a group of cells known as Wernicke's area. This is an area that is critical for speech. the Wernicke's area located in the left hemisphere allows us to comprehend or interpret speech and to put words together in correct syntax when speaking. So it's allowing the input and the output. In other words, you're taking in the information, that's the input where you are comprehending or interpreting speech, you know, said to you, and you're able to do the output to put your own words together in correct syntax and speak those words. So most times you don't have output until you have enough input so that you know what you're doing and you can then feel comfortable with some output. That's just like when a baby is learning to speak. It's not speaking except for maybe, you know, da, 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 ma, 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 ma. But it's not forming bigger words until it gets way more input. So that Wernicke's area, because it's critical for speech and for speaking with correct syntax, if you know anybody who has a stroke in that area, that is what they have to work on building back up, which takes a long time and very intense, but it is possible to rebuild that comprehension and interpretation of speech and also learning to put correct syntax together and actually speak. We'll see a little later that another area, which is Broca's area, which is on the right side of the brain, is actually necessary to produce the speech. So actually saying the words is on the right side, Broca's area, but comprehending and interpreting and then putting together the correct syntax in your mind, that's the Wernicke's area. So Broca on the right and Wernicke on the left. I never really remembered which one went where, but I'll have to think of some mnemonic device to remember which side is which one. So Broca's area, you know, prepares you to produce the speech. So now, unfortunately, we're just about to get to the parietal lobe. I may have enough time to finish it, and if not, I may start with that next time. But the parietal lobes, sometimes as a result of a stroke in the right hemisphere of the brain, people are left with a strange disorder called anosognosia, meaning lack of knowledge of illness. These people are often paralyzed on the left side of their bodies but are unaware of their problem. They treat the left side of their bodies as if it wasn't there, refusing to comb their hair on that side or even refusing to put clothes on that half of the body. To understand how this strange disorder could occur, we need to look at the part of the cortex that handles spatial awareness and orientation. So, you know, being aware of where you are in space and to be able to orient yourself is a very important part of the brain's responsibility. At the top of the brain is a flat, plate-like area in each hemisphere. So touch the very top of your brain that seems to be a little flat on each side of the brain. And these are called the parietal lobes. And those lobes consist of two major subdivisions, the anterior and posterior parts, that play different but complementary roles. And I think I will at this point, I'll maybe another part of a paragraph, and then we'll have to get going. So within the anterior or front part of the parietal lobes, immediately behind the motor cortex, which the motor cortex, if you had a headband around right in front of your ears, that's about where the motor cortex is. So right behind there are the edge of the parietal lobes, and it lies a strip of cells called the somatosensory cortex, the somatosensory cortex. And I would say that that is pretty much right above the ears. Just as we need to send information to the muscles in our body about when and how to move, we also need to be able to receive information such as touch, temperature from our environment, sensations of pain and pressure from the skin, and the position of our limbs, which is proprioception, knowing where you are in space. This is accomplished by the somatosensory cortex, Well, listen, it's been great reading to you again this week. I hope to do more next week. Have a great weekend, and please take care of your brain. Thank you so much.